I actually was a very close-minded person. I was a skeptical debunker of all of this
Wow.
stuff. I hated conspiracies and UFOs and psychics and religion and consciousness and spirituality. It wasn't just wrong, it was offensive to me. I thought it was immoral to spread pseudoscience and conspiracy theories. And I had other skeptic friends who would be like, oh, I want to believe, but I can't. And I would say, why do you want to believe? I'm glad it's not real. I don't want to live in a universe where any of this shit is real. Like, I'm
Wow.
very happy living in a cold, dead, impersonal, meaningless universe. And so I didn't have like a UFO sighting that changed my life. Actually, that never happened. Instead, it was like death by a thousand cuts. It was, just constantly being exposed to more and more information and struggling to debunk it.
Welcome to Far Out Faust, everybody. I am Faust Chicho, and today I'm excited and I'm honored to be joined by Michael Mazzola. Let me tell you about this incredible man and what he has been up to. He is the director of some of the most influential and iconic UFO documentaries of all time, including my absolute personal favorites, which many of you have watched if you've been following and listening to me, Unacknowledged, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, Missing 411, The UFO Connection, and most recently, a very, very important documentary. If you have not seen it, see it ASAP. It's called The Lost Century. As a producer and a UFO consultant for film and TV, working with some of the most prestigious artists and companies in Hollywood, he strives to bring authenticity and integrity to how UFO stories are told. Michael also co-founded Entangled, and that's a quantum physics R&D company in Irvine, California, and has grown numerous businesses in the cyber intelligence, cyber marketing, blockchain, and entertainment sectors. He sits on the board of the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, whose mission is to bridge the gap between Hollywood filmmakers and real experiencers and experts. He studied film and TV at NYU. And without further ado, Michael, thank you so much for beaming in. It is an honor to have you, brother.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
How did you end up first of all, like, were you recommended to Dr. Greer? How did you end up in his, and then obviously he loved your work because he kept using you, and you went on to produce and direct my absolute highly recommended. I mean, I have this list on my YouTube channel that I keep sending everyone to. It's called Faust Highly Recommends. I don't know what else to call it, but all your docs are on there. They're all top of my list, and I'm constantly telling people, like, you need to understand the situation in order to believe what I'm saying. But how did you meet him? How did you end up working with him?
So first of all, thank you so much for the compliments. I'm not used to hearing this kind of feedback, so I really appreciate it. I didn't know him. I had donated to Sirius, the first movie he did with Armady Kalika, and I got to go to the premiere in L.A. and I tried to shake his hand at the premiere, but there was an entourage there that was like, go away, go away, creepy person. But I met Adam Curry at the premiere. He was in Sirius. I thought he was the most impressive part of that film. He's a consciousness researcher and inventor. So I went up to him and we became friends. He's now my best friend, and we've started businesses together. And so we're working on building a quantum physics R&D company. And I was, still watching Greer all the time on YouTube and reading his books and everything. And I saw Greer put out a call for a filmmaker. He says in one of his videos, oh, we're looking for someone to make the next documentary. And I got so excited. But then I saw that this video was like 6 months old, and I thought, oh, well, you know, there's no way. But just in case, I'll send an email. So I sent a cold email, and a few days later, I was on the phone with Dr. Greer, and, you know, a month later, I moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, and signed a lease and, you know, started going through, you know, the archives, which are all just in his, you know, in boxes in his basement, just thousands of, he calls it the mouse turd files. And it's an accurate description, right? Just thousands of CIA documents, just, you know, so like looking for the gems and, yeah, that's how it got started.
Wow. That's amazing. What a call to be returned 6 months later, you know, you're like, fuck it. I would have been the same thing. I would have been like, there's no way that this position is still open, but what the hell?
Yeah.
I'll email anyway. That's amazing. And so you had to pick up and move. Were you in California or were you in New York?
Yeah, I was born and raised in LA, went to school in New York and came straight back. And
you're like, it's too fucking cold there.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So you how long did you end up having to stay in proximity to, I mean, because documentaries sometimes they take years to collect.
Yeah. I ended up in Charlottesville for only about 6 months. Okay. And then we moved the production to Vegas. And then I finished it in California. So it was a little bit chaotic. But it ended up working out. And I never thought anyone would see that movie. You know, like I thought, oh, this will go on Vimeo and maybe a few thousand people would see it. Like I had no idea you know, what it was about to do. And it was just, I was in complete shock for the longest time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to quantify how many people saw that movie because it's been around and it's been, you know, it was on, you know, YouTube. I mean, Dr. Greer thinks that probably 1 billion people saw it. I don't know. That's a huge number. I don't know if that many people saw it, but certainly I think you've broken to the hundreds of millions. I think between all the copies that have gone around and the, you know, the pirating and all that.
Yeah. And that's how we kind of figured out kind of a ballpark. Because our distributor wasn't very good at dealing with the piracy. So we were working with a cyber marketing firm that also could do piracy. And we're like, hey, can you just do an assessment of how badly this movie is getting pirated? And they came back with something like, you know, 600 million torrent streams, you know, some insane number. And this was at the end of 2017, right? Yeah. So I think he kind of extrapolates from there. It's like, okay, so if it's like 600 million at that point, and then you add in, you know, 5 years and Netflix and Hulu and the sales we know about, it's a lot, you know?
Yeah. That's amazing, dude. That's, I mean, I'll never forget, you know, when Mick Jagger was on Rogan, you know, and I'm going to show that clip.
Oh, Steven Tyler.
Steven Tyler. Yeah. What did I say? Steven Tyler was on Rogan.
Have you not watched Unacknowledged?
What is Unacknowledged?
You got to watch Unacknowledged.
What is that one?
Okay. You got to watch Unacknowledged.
What is it?
You got to watch Unacknowledged.
Is that Stephen Greer movie?
He was, and it's so funny because Dr. Greer was on Rogan when Rogan was much more of a hardcore skeptic. And so the whole vibe of their interview is just like, you're like, I mean, you're watching it 6 years later and you're like, what the fuck is, what is going
it's
on
so
with
cringy.
This guy? You know what I mean?
It's so cringy. I can't watch it. It's so bad. No. It makes me so uncomfortable.
Me too. And I'm like, what is happening? What? And then I realize how long ago it was. And, you know, Rogan goes through phases. No, I don't think he's going through any more phases now. Now that kind of the cat's out of the bag, but you know, what are you going to do? It sucks. I wish he'd have him back on, but you know. So tell me what did you? Obviously, you had a very open mind. If you like myself, you know, you donated to Dr. Greer's films. You know, I was actually supposed to go to the premiere of CE5, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. And I had plans to meet Dr. Greer because we were, long story short, we were trying to get him to be on a show we were doing called The Last Supper. And it was the show we were just launching, where I was going to go around and shoot what would be whatever the enlightened person that we chose as our guest, Dr. Greer would have been the first, whatever he would have if this was his last meal on earth. And then I was going to ask him, you know, these 15 questions we laid out about, you know, about life, about the cosmos. And we were going to make
cool
a show.
Concept.
Yeah. We were going to do a different guru, you know, slash person who we really loved and admired and for every episode. And then of course, you know, Shklovid, you know, the shit hit the fan with the fascists of the world, and then everything got shut down, and I couldn't even go to the premiere. I was so disappointed.
Same, I couldn't go either.
You know, I probably would have met you there.
Yep.
But before you started working on this film, you know, you probably had a few ideas about what was true, and then once you got into the basement and then shooting this and coming out of it, how much of your understanding and beliefs changed? You know, like how blown away were you?
Well, maybe you a few years before I even knew about Dr. Greer and donated to Sirius, I actually was a very close-minded person. I was a skeptical debunker of all of this stuff. I hated conspiracies and UFOs and psychics and religion and consciousness and spirituality. It wasn't just wrong. It was offensive to me. I thought it was immoral to spread pseudoscience and conspiracy theories. And I had other skeptic friends who would be like, oh, I want to believe, but I can't. And I would say, why do you want to believe? I'm glad it's not real. I don't want to live in a universe where any of this shit is real. Like, I'm very happy living in a cold, dead, impersonal, meaningless universe. And so I didn't have like a UFO sighting that changed my life. Actually, that never happened. Instead, it was like death by a thousand cuts. You know, it was... Mm-hmm. You know, just constantly being exposed to more and more information and struggling to debunk it. And, you know, I was really looking at arguments against my own position, not because I thought I might be wrong, but because I wanted to just defeat any argument that came my way. I was such an asshole. Like, I loved to fight with people. And so, you know, but when you read like Dean Radin's books, and if you look at Dr. Greer's material, you can't debunk it. The skeptic's motto, which was my motto, which is, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Well, the extraordinary evidence is there, right? And when I realized it was there and it's been there for decades, I was like, oh, these skeptics that I'm, you know, idolizing, you know, like Michael Shermer and James Randi, they're total bad faith actors, you know, they're completely insincere. And then I had to ask myself, well, why is it that I didn't just not believe, but I also did not want it to be true? And the answer that came to me immediately is, well, if any of this stuff is true, you have to take responsibility for it. Right. So like, if the media is lying to us about everything, I can't just be a passive consumer of information. I have to, you know, now it's going to be my full-time job to fact check everything. You know, if we're living in a universe where our consciousness has some kind of relationship with the fabric of reality, I have to take responsibility for my thoughts. That's horrifying. Right. I was so depressed. Right. I was not like, oh my God, I'm this powerful being. It was more like, oh my God, I have
fucking catatonic,
all this
right?
Shit, yeah. All this toxic shit. And if there's really a UFO cover up, I can't just keep that to myself. So I have a lot of compassion for our skeptical or cynical brothers and sisters, because it's not about evidence. It's never been about evidence, or at least it hasn't been about evidence for decades. It's about, you know, the responsibility that we're asking these people to take on, it's enormous. I mean, this completely transformed every aspect of my life. So I think we have to have some compassion for what we're actually asking people to do. And we say, hey, come join our movement. So anyway, so the way that I was going to take responsibility for all this stuff was I was going to make films because that's the only thing I knew how to do. So that's why I put my hand up and said, hey, I would love to do this.
Wow. That's fucking incredible. I had no idea that I really would have never expected that. But that is music to my ears because one of the people listening to this will be someone who I work closely with, who is my resident skeptic as well. He's more of a traditional skeptic. The thing about everything you're saying is absolutely true. And you know, I try to have a lot of compassion for skeptics because I know that there's a subconscious element to their skepticism that many of them have not unearthed. And I believe, just like you said, you know, it manifests itself consciously in a lot of ways. It's like, you know, evidence and all this stuff. And sometimes that'll sway, but more so I feel like there's this, and I don't know how else to phrase it, but it is in part due to, an innocent kind of good-heartedness, like an inability to realize that the world could possibly be so fucking corrupt and fucked up, you know, first of all, because that's an avalanche, you know, for people who have certain belief systems, you know, to acknowledge how broken our system is a paradigm shift that I think most people, you know, they don't have the spiritual fortitude to take it yet, you know, and many of them need to die by 1,000 cuts as you did, and come around to it. But, you know, I think that on the other side of it is a much more fulfilling life, you know, that you can be responsible for. And I hear you, you know, it's like when you realize just how much you're responsible for and how conscious you have to be of your thoughts and feelings, it's like, you know, it's a fucking slap in the face.
It is. That's why I found comfort in a cold, dead, impersonal universe, because I wasn't responsible for anything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a victim of circumstance, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, when I made Unacknowledged, that was just my way of processing my trauma of like confronting all this terrifying shit that's in that movie, you know? Mm-hmm. But now, however many years later, you know, 6 years later, whatever it's been, you know, now I have a lot of regrets about, you know, the mistakes I've made in communicating with other people about this information. Mm-hmm. And so right now my main focus is how can we interact with this information, with these truths, with these revelations, with these mysteries in a way that makes our life better, that makes us happier and enriches us, instead of just scaring the shit out of us and making us feel powerless, you know? Yes.
It's a challenge, you know, I mean, I am, you know, the truther community, that's a wide range of folks right now. And some of us are more spiritually minded than others. And some of us, you know, have a better grasp on this, but you realize you can't be going around and slapping people in the face with the truth. You know, your first step forward is a very negative reinforcement, you know, that is, you know, going to be right in the face of that ego, that whoever it is, and they're going to be much, much less susceptible to the information if you have, you know, fucking pulled their pants down and slapped them in the face in front of everyone and been like, this is how fucking wrong you are. Be afraid. Be very afraid. You know, the world is not what you thought. They're going to be like, you know, you can put them in denial and shock. So it's a constant challenge, you know, how to present information where you can at least get them to take a step forward on that bridge, you know, that they need to cross in order to see things the way that they are, as opposed to, you know, the veil that's been put down. So I hear you. It's a struggle. It's definitely a struggle.
It is. Yeah. And, you know, there are other mistakes and other things I figured out along the way too. I'm happy to share some embarrassing stories if you want.
Sure, you know? Man. Sure. You know, I mean, look, it's the first thing I think many of us do when we have this awakening is fucking run and tell everyone. It's like, and it's, you know, like the fucking mailman's at the door. You're like, dude, did you know? And people just think that you're a little crazy, but then you realize like, okay, that's, maybe this isn't the best course of action, but I want to hear your story.
Yeah, but I fucking ran and I told everyone. I told hundreds of millions of people, and I should have, you know, in retrospect, maybe thought about, you know, a solution I was going to offer, you know, now that I've alerted everyone to this, you know, global fascist takeover, yeah. You know, instead of just leaving people with that, you know, but it's okay. We all make mistakes.
Well, you know, hindsight is 20/20, as they say. But you know, you the great thing that you did do was it was the first time I think that an official, you know, true expose came out that gave people the whole story if they were fucking patient enough to stay to the third act, you know. And I tell everyone, don't miss the third act because it's everything. You need to understand the third act for everything else to make sense. It's the reward for sitting through the first two, which is, you know, it becomes uncomfortable for people to be bombarded, you know, with all that information. And then finally they're like, okay, I get it. But then, you know, the third act is like, look, this is why. Do you understand? Do you understand now? So I love the way you structured it. And you couldn't have structured it any other way, but I hear you. But I mean, you had to feel some redemption with Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was a warning itself, but yeah. At least there was some hope in it.
Oh yeah. You know, but I, you know, again, I thought, okay, well sure. Unacknowledged was popular because that was, you know, that was designed to do what you just said. It was designed to bring people from 0 to 60 in 2 hours. You know, people who knew nothing. It was the movie you could put in front of your grandmother and red pill her. You know, mm-hmm. Which is what I was hoping Sirius was going to be, you know, and I really liked Sirius and I think it's a great film, but you had people doing CE5 10 minutes into the film. So I tried showing that to my mom and my sister and they're like, what the fuck is that? You got people telepathically, yeah. What the fuck is that? You know, because they weren't even on board with UFOs being real, let alone we could telepathically summon them. So I'm like, oh shit, you know? So when I connected with Dr. Greer, I was so happy that we were totally in alignment on this, that it's like, yeah, no CE5 in this movie. No. This is disclosure potty training, right? Mm-hmm. So by the time we got to CE5, I'm like, yeah, well, no one's going to want to see this movie because this is way too weird. So mm-hmm. I was right back in the same place of thinking no one's going to want to see this, you know? And then it was even bigger than Unacknowledged. And I'm just sitting there like, what the fuck is going on? And I've seen things happen in the last few years that I never thought I would see in my lifetime. And that's when I realized, well, it's not, you know, it's not because I'm such a good filmmaker. It's not because we have these amazing budgets, because we don't, you know, and it's not because these are the greatest films ever made. They're far from it. You know, they're little crowdfunded documentaries. It's because there's a higher intelligence that's shining through them. Not mine. I'm not saying it's my higher intelligence shining through it, but there's, you know, it's the same higher intelligence that's been guiding this movement, you know, and Dr. Greer, he fucking knows it. You know, he knew that Unacknowledged was going to accomplish what it did. And same thing with CE5. And, you know, he's the visionary behind these things. And I had no faith at all, but I just said, okay, it's my job. I'm going to just do it, you know, and do the best I can.
Listen, you are a conduit, my friend. You deserve some credit because you sent the email and you got the job and then you got another job and you were the right man for the job. Those films speak for themselves. They're very, very easy to watch. They get better and better. I mean, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind is as awesome as Unacknowledged is. Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, in my opinion, was a step up in filmmaking. You know, it just, I know that maybe the budget was a little bigger. And I also want to clarify.
No, it was smaller.
It was smaller.
But I was I was figuring out how to make a movie because Unacknowledged was the first one, you know? I'd only done little short things in school. So
for people who haven't experience making films, as you learn how to make films, you can make better films for less money. Like the first film I made was fucking astronomical. I mean, it was like, it was almost $500,000 in budget.
Oh shit.
and it was an independent thriller. We didn't make our money back. Okay. The next film I made was for $200,000. Just as good as a film. It was a thriller. They ended up marketing it as a horror and we sold it to IFC and we made our money back. It was a harder film to make, but we made it for like not even half. And then I learned how to do it again and again. So that's what Michael is talking about. But dude, so that film, man, I love that film. It's so prophetic with everything that happened. It just made all, you know, Daniel Sheehan and all those guys, they're just telling you what's happening. And then of course it happens.
And then it happens. You know, I mean, Danny Sheehan sitting there saying To the Stars Academy is a shady counterintelligence operation, you know, and that's just pushing this phony threat agenda. And then Lou Elizondo quits To the Stars Academy and hires Danny Sheehan as his attorney. Now, Danny's one of my best friends, and I can't divulge personal conversations, but if we just apply a little bit of logic, it seems like he might have been onto something. You know, it's not that he changed his mind about what TTSA was, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, we shook those guys up and I'm very proud of that. You know,
yeah.
I give myself a little credit. I don't give myself credit for much, but I give myself a little credit for having a role in taking down TTSA.
So. Yeah. And look, I think Daniel Sheehan is chock full of integrity. I think that if he's involved with them, it's because he wants to oversee, you know, whatever they're doing and whatever, you know, they're working on in a way that will actually benefit people, you know, as opposed to continue the government secrecy. So, you know, I know that there was like a whole big melodrama with when Sheehan went to them and people were like, he's betrayed Dr. Greer. And I'm like, I'm sure that it wasn't, you know, I'm sure he had his reasons. I don't know how bad, if it was a breakup or what, but, you know.
And then, you know, and then Danny was at our event in DC on June 12th, the new disclosure press conference. He was sitting right there in the front row, you know. So, you know, there's always UFO conference. Politics, you know, and there's always going to be disagreements and whatever. But, you know, ultimately, Dr. Greer and Danny are trying to accomplish the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And they work great in tandem together. And I'm sure they shook hands there. I'm sure that they, you know, said, oh, I hope they did. You know, I love both men.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They greeted each other with hugs and, you know, so Greer invited Danny to the event. So.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. Yeah. That's good news. I was always, you know, the internet loves to take a little spark of drama and turn it into a fucking bonfire. So I, you know, I was like trying to find out the truth, but it's tough when you're using third party sources. But that's remarkable. So Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. So I do these, I make a lot of videos, for YouTube, but I also do a lot of, live broadcasts, mostly on Instagram. I'm starting to do more on, and I teach people about CE5, you know, and about how to make contact. And then I come up against some of the people who are, you know, more religious minded, and they're like, you know, there's a fear factor involved. And I encourage them, you know, I explain to them how the protocols work and where they come from, and I'm like, you don't have to wait for them to land to connect. You know, you can do this. Anybody with, you know, a functioning heart and mind can do this. You don't even need a lot of people. I was doing it in my Manhattan apartment by myself with a fucking headlamp on for many nights. Okay. Like a great fool. I even had it flashing a few nights. I was like, maybe this will help.
Did you have any orbs come in?
Well, I was on the east side, and I was facing west because it was the only view I had, and I connected twice, and I'll never forget it. I never saw a ship, and I realized, you know, how the insanity of what I was looking to do, you know, asking them to, you know, materialize in fucking Manhattan so I could wave high. But I was like, so I was really deep in this beautiful void. And honestly, it was like one of the deepest meditations I've ever got myself into. And it was just total black. It was nothing. I was so far gone. And out of this nothing, this ship appeared in my mind. Like, and it appeared through a cloud cover out of nowhere. And I was like, you know, it snapped me out of this void I was in. And I was,
you were
like,
remote viewing that.
Totally. And they were connecting me, and I was like, hello. And it was just kind of like, I had this greeting, you know, of a feeling, and I gave it back. And it was, I was just like, thank you. And I was like, that's what Dr. Greer means when he says, you know, you can connect, you know, you can remote view and you can connect. You don't have to do it physically. It can happen physically, and it does.
Yes.
But a lot of times it starts with that. And so that was like, I would have doubted it, but I was like, it was, you know, it was like getting slapped in the face. It wasn't something that I conjured up. It was, you know, it was just there, vivid. And I was like, wow, I would have woken up my wife, but it was late in the night. Yeah. And I had a
dude, that is so on. Cool. And that's a side of CE5 that actually never gets discussed very much. Everyone's so focused on you know, phenomena manifesting, yeah, you know, so that we could film it. But there's been so many transcendent, amazing experiences that are just happening in consciousness. And the truth is, all of it's happening in consciousness, yes, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's really cool. Thank you for sharing that experience.
Oh yeah. So I don't know if I've ever shared that, you know, online before, but it was, I mean, I'm always a little like, people are going to think I'm crazy. Like, and maybe I was a little crazy, but I was having fun. And, people should know that yes, there's a really amazing excitement and energy when you're with the right group of people, and then a craft shows up, because it's undeniable. It's right in front of you. You know what I mean? And sometimes it's right there on the ground, you know, and when you're seeing more than one, and you're like, this can't, you know, even a hardcore skeptic is going to be a little blown away. I mean, they may walk away being like, how the fuck did they set up those lights?
Yeah.
You know, people have all kinds of ways that they, you know, they just write it off. But this other part of it, and I'm like, look, you can be the greatest skeptic, but if you're willing to try, you know, you might be able to find out something that you don't know. Yeah. But, you know, skeptics are skeptics.
Yes, they are. Well, you know, even when I was making CE5, I wasn't taking my own meditation practice very seriously. You know, I was still very much stuck in you know, fear-based consciousness of, mm-hmm, oh, we've got to make this movie, we have to warn people about what's going on, and, you know, and it was, you know, kind of hypocritical. Because here we're talking about these beautiful things, but I wasn't practicing what I was preaching, really. You know, I would try here and there, but I super wasn't into it. And then, you know, with COVID, I started really taking spirituality seriously and having the most transcendent, incredible experiences in meditation and also with psychedelics. And, you know, to our religious brothers and sisters, I cannot say it enough. You know, it's one thing to have beliefs about the spiritual realm and read about it and have your convictions about it. And it's another thing to actually directly touch that realm and experience God or whatever you want to call it. It's the difference between reading about sex and having sex. Like you can't even, you can't even imagine, and so, you know, I, as a result, I've stopped trying to, you know, I'm no longer oriented around, you know, the mission of trying to wake people up and we got to get people on our team. And, you know, people come to me and say, oh, I've seen your movies. And what do I do? What do I do? I say, have you done mushrooms? Have you tried LSD?
Have you tried LSD? Do you
and they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, you know, here, you want a microdose? You know, I carry them around with me. You know, yeah, there you go. You know, it's a complete 180 shift from where I was when I started making these films. And now I'm just, you know, completely monomaniacally focused on, you know, the frequency that I'm putting out there instead of being preoccupied with what the quote unquote bad guys are doing, because what the bad guys are doing is just a reflection of something that's broken within myself. And by getting stressed out about what's happening in the world, I'm just putting more energy into that. And so this is where I've spent a lot of time thinking, oh God, have I made these problems worse by bringing them to light? I've decided I don't think I have. But it's something I've wrestled with. And so now with the films we're working on, I'm making sure that, like, we still have like some crazy shit. Like we've got these new witnesses. I don't know if you saw the event in June. Yeah.
You know, I did.
Okay, so we've.
I was going to go, but I had a lot of obligations with my kids, but I wanted to be there. I had a lot of friends there.
So
but I mean, it was a great event.
Great event, crazy stuff. They were on. They've done some podcasts, but they're making their film debut in this film that we're editing now. But I'm just making sure that this thing is like fun and not going to stress people out. You know. I don't want to feed into the conspiracism and the dialectic anymore.
Yeah. See, part of what I do is point out the dialectic. So I'm in this space where people are like, man, you know, and I get this comment once in a while and I don't know how to feel about it, but at the same time, I have to remind myself that ignorance is bliss right up until you die from it. You know what I'm saying? and I would rather people, and I try to present the information that, you know, it's something they could then look and say, holy shit, that's true. It's really true. You know, George Bush's brother really did work security for the World Trade right up until 2001, while also being a chair of Los Alamos, a company that makes the most advanced thermite explosives on the planet, you know, and the Bushes are longtime family friends of the Bin Ladens. Go figure. George Sr. was having breakfast with the Bin Laden family in DC the morning of 9/11. Just a few coincidences for you, you know, and people are like, why isn't this fact checked?
And I'm like, because it's all fucking true. This, but it's making me very uncomfortable. And I just want to say, buildings always pulverize themselves into dust when you poke a hole in them. I just want to be on record. You know?
Yeah, it's true. So. Office fires can be deadly. People, and they're like, wow. They're like, I didn't know that. You know, it's so upsetting, but I'm so glad you told me. And I'm like, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but you need to understand the world we're living in before we can change it. You know what I'm saying? So I feel you. And I, you know, part of me just wants to make videos about quantum physics and about, you know, the heart mind connection and about how powerful we are and our innate ability to change this world and heal ourselves and do all these amazing things. But I also know that what gets traction and followers are also these other subjects, which people should know about, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm constantly being like, how do I navigate this space? Because I'm not going to obsess over what they're doing. I know their plan. I know what they're always working towards. I'm going to focus on me. I have a daily spiritual practice. I'm pretty consistent with it. You know, I also, 2020 was also a great liberator for me. You know, I didn't have any of these tattoos before 2020. I was an actor.
They're sick.
And so I hid my, you know, what I wanted to do, I had to hide because I didn't want to be typecast, you know. And then 2020 came and I was like, I'm free. I'm my own. I'm a free agent now. You know, I'm no longer beholden to this notion. And I started to do things I loved. You know, the guy I was working with, great. Maybe you've heard of him. His name is Hunter Richards. He was he's a director. He's very spiritual. He directed a film called London with Chris Evans and Jessica Biel. Great film. Mm-hmm. He wrote it and directed it. But he's a very spiritual dude. And he was like, we have to do something. We're going to make a podcast. I'm like, we are? He's like, yeah, we can't just sit around like this because we were shut down. He's like, you're going to host it. I'm like, all right. Yeah. Yeah. He's like, I can't fucking host it. I don't get in front of the camera. Okay. You're going to host it. I'm going to help. I'm like, all right, let's do it. You know, and I love this. I love what I'm doing. I'm creating content, which I feel is making a difference, you know? So, but it is a challenge to try to do it without being, you know, the messenger that they want to shoot.
Right.
You know?
Well,
yeah. So I feel you.
I in 2021, so here's an embarrassing story I have not admitted publicly anywhere. I'm happy to do it here. I was absolutely convinced that the food supply was going to collapse. Hmm. You know, we were seeing all these stories about food packaging plants getting blown up. And I was like, oh, my God.
They were getting fucking blown up. They were.
Oh, yeah, they totally were, right? And so my conspiracy theorist mind was extrapolating from there. I was like, okay, this is the next stage of the apocalypse that we're going through, right? So I spent thousands of dollars on emergency food for me and for my family because they wouldn't do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just stockpiling. Like I became a crazy prepper, you know, in my tiny little apartment. I don't have space for any of this shit. Right. But I was just completely convinced. And I was so depressed. I never really got scared about COVID, but I was scared to death about this. Yeah. And I was really just looking around my neighborhood and like saying goodbye, like this is all, you know, it's going to turn into a zombie apocalypse. And, you know, and so I really like let go and I'm like, well, fuck it. You know, if this is the end, I'm going to start doing the things I've always wanted to do. Right. So I signed up for this hardcore meditation retreat. And nice. I signed up for acting classes and tennis lessons and all this other shit that I had just been putting off forever because I was too busy. And then the world didn't end, but my world ended because I suddenly realized what life is really about. It's about meditation and acting classes and tennis lessons and having fun. And like, I was eating out. I'm like, oh, fuck it. I'm going to just spend money like, you know, like crazy because I want to live. I want to live it up. And I was having so much fun for the first time in my adult life. I was just relaxed and allowing myself to just have a blast. And I realized, oh, shit, these conspiracy theories, you know, have made me fucking miserable.
Yeah.
And I don't want to live like that anymore. And so that was such a profound shift for me. And since then I've been just totally prioritizing you know, being a little more financially responsible, but, you know, prioritizing my own, you know, well-being.
Yeah.
And realizing that I'm not doing the world any favors if I'm stressing out the UFO cover-up and the bad guys. And I'm just perpetuating this dialectic, you know, and Danny Sheehan says to me, like, Michael, we have to transcend this. We can't be in a good versus evil dialectic with the people controlling the UFO programs, because they've got all the technology and they're going to win. So we have to transcend that dialectic. And you know, it's the same thing that Greer says, like, we're going to do this through frequency and consciousness and manifesting a better world.
And they're both absolutely right. You know, I often imagine this movie that I want to create one day. It'll never get off the ground. They'll never let me make it, but it would be like the United States military versus the military industrial complex, the underground, you know. I always remember that story of that Dr. Greer tells of when the five-star general Eisenhower went down and was like, you're gonna open that fucking door for me, you know, or I'm gonna fucking send the 101st Airborne Division to break it down. And they were like, all right, just show them some, you know, show them some stuff and then put the rest of the stuff away. And but like, imagine if that came to blows, you know, and it almost did, but they ended up showing them, you know, probably a fucking broom closet. But I have these crazy ideas about what would happen, but they have all the technology. Let's be real. You know, they have the power, and the technology. So we need to transcend it. And it's not going to be done by pointing fingers and trying to, you know, all these people are like, they're going to burn in hell. I'm like, not helping.
Maybe for a few minutes, you know.
You know, yeah. You know, but I don't. You know, I just don't think that's going to solve anything. And I don't. And people are like, well, even at the press conference, someone said, Billy Carson, someone who I've had on my show, asked Dr. Greer, and it's a good question, and it's a question people want to know, because we live in this duality. You know, people are like, are they going to be held accountable? And I'm like, And I love Dr. Greer's answer. He was like, right now, we're just trying to get them to talk to us. You know, we're trying to open up lines of communication. He was like, we don't have any plans to fucking have tribunals. And Jesus, you know what I mean? Like, let's let them come out of the shadows before we try to, you know, fucking handcuff them and throw them in prison. Then we'll never get the keys to the locks that they have, the safes.
Good luck handcuffing someone who possesses literally magical technology, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And unlimited wealth and power and probably off planet infrastructure.
Just in case you thought you could corner them.
go knock on their door and, you know, serve a warrant. But yeah, you know, you mentioned Eisenhower. People don't appreciate like how weird it is for an outgoing president to use his last moments, his final farewell speech, not to brag about his accomplishments, but to issue a warning, you know, about the military industrial complex and a scientific and technological elite. What do you think he was talking about? You know, it's because he lost control of this, you know?
He did. And he told Kennedy. You know, he let Kennedy know, and Kennedy knew more than most. Probably was the last president to really have a lot of knowledge about this shit. You know, too much, probably. Not, I mean, too much, so much that, I mean, he was killed for 1,000 reasons. Let's be real. But this was one of the reasons, you know, one of the bigger reasons. Poor Marilyn. Oh, for sure. She didn't know what she was signing up for, that poor woman.
She did not.
You know, it's just, but you know what they did to him is the same parties, you know, that came back around for 9/11, and the same parties that orchestrate all this madness. And a lot of people don't agree with me, but I believe that, you know, that this planet and we humans, we are angels. You know, we are meant to be angels. And we have been subjected to such terrors and trauma that we have, you know, been completely convinced that we're living on hell when this was meant to be a heaven, you know. And I think that's what is inherent in all of us is good. It's not this bullshit that they teach us that we're, you know, you have original sin and you need to be fucking, first thing that happens is you get an exorcism. Oh, great. We're exorcising babies now. You know, like that's basically what the baptism is, casting out. Yeah. I'm like, what the fuck is, and I was raised
that. It's psychotic. I mean, it's completely psychotic. And I have religious trauma. You know, I mean, I got off easy. It was just Catholic education, but a lot of our evangelical brothers and sisters, I mean, they're just, you know, what they're taught is so, it's such a terrifying way to go through life. You know, there's a devil lurking, you know,
traumatizing.
Yeah. And again, if you try to, there's so many ways to do it through different meditation traditions, through plant medicine, through chanting, even through certain kinds of prayer, and other things. Like, if you participate in a direct experience with the divine realm, you realize that everything is perfect. Yeah. Like everything's completely fine. And there is no reason to be stressed out about any of this shit. You know, the first time I did a mushroom ceremony, I was laughing my ass off at the end of it because I felt like I'd been let in on the big cosmic joke, and the joke was on me because I took everything so seriously when really we're just in this divine simulation, and everything is just love.
Yeah.
And then I just became obsessed with, you know, trying to access that as often as possible.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had more profound experiences in meditation than even through psychedelics. But psychedelics are a fantastic way into this, you know?
Yes.
This needs to be our priority, you know?
Yes. I talk about it often. I encourage people. I'm like, you don't want to hear it, but have you begun to still your mind enough that, you know, if you happen to try and talk to God, that are you being quiet enough to actually hear an answer? Because you will get an answer. You know, if you can talk to God anytime you want, you can talk to Jesus, you can talk to the archangels, you can talk to whoever you want, but you got to be quiet enough to hear the answer, you know, and then trust what you hear. Oh, I heard it, but it was in my voice. Well, what voice would you like to hear? Would you like to hear the voice of Moses? You know, would you like Charleston Heston to speak to you in the same voice that he, you know, I mean, what other voice could he talk to you in but your own? It's amazing to me. You know, it makes me think of one of my favorite books, Conversations with God. If you haven't read it, you'll love it.
By Neil Donald Walsh. I haven't read it.
Oh, you'll love it. Read Conversations with God. It's an amazing piece of, it's a dialogue, okay? It's a dialogue this man had. This cranky old man who was at the end of his rope, he picked up his legal pad and he wrote an angry letter to God. And when he went to pull his hand back, his hand stopped and he was like, "What? Oh shit." And it started writing a response. It was like, "Are you just venting or do you really want answers?" And he was like, both.
And really, and this is what it is. I've heard of this book. I know it was super popular with like,
this is how it started generation. On a legal pad.
Yeah.
No, like literally this old dude divorced 6 times, writing a fucking angry letter to God being like, why, you know, and then when he went to pull back the pencil, it stopped and started writing a response to his shock.
Wow.
You know, and these legal pads then became, you know, this communication he had. And then, you know, this higher power said, "You're going to have to publish these." And he's like, "What?" What? Are you serious? He's like, we're not just having this conversation for us. But listen, when you read this book and you read the answers, listen, I read Neil's writing and it ain't that good. Okay. I mean, I love the man. He's amazing, but he's not that good of a writer. The answers that he gets from this, you know, from this entity, from God, who this, like, he, you know, it, they're just perfect.
And there was no ChatGPT back then, so it couldn't
And there was no ChatGPT, you know. So it was right from, I believe it was right from this. I've read the books. I've read each of them, you know, 3-4 times. And I always return to them because they grant me, there's such a feeling of relief when I read these books, you know.
All right, I'm ordering these as soon as we hang up.
Oh, you're gonna laugh. You're gonna cry. You're gonna love them. They're fantastic books. But he always talks about in this book. He's like, if, because Neil asks all the questions you would think that, you know, if you had a Q&A with God, what would you ask him? Be like, why don't you just appear? Why can't you just? And God is like, if I appeared to you as one thing, the moment you went and told your friend Johnny, he's going to say, that's not what God looks like. You know, he's not going to believe you. He's going to say, because it says here in my book that God appeared like this. And if I appear one way, how, you know, there's always going to be a problem with the way I appear, you know, but I am in everything. I'm always up there. And it's like every answer. I mean, I didn't do it much justice, but it's very, very laid back and laid out for you. So you can't, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful book. The answers are perfect. You'll see what I mean when you read them. It's brilliant.
Far out, dude. I'm excited to read that.
Yeah.
Have you had Jeffrey Martin on your show?
No. Jeffrey Martin. Wait, that sounds familiar.
So this guy's a psychologist, Dr. Jeffrey Martin at Sophia University, at some university in Northern California. And so like 30 years ago, he wanted to study enlightenment. You know, he wanted to start really sort of mapping out the spectrum of enlightenment experiences that people from different meditative traditions were describing. And he realized that not everyone was experiencing the same thing. Right. Mm-hmm. So he called them locations, you know, location one, location two, location three, location. It was like 15 of them, you know, and they run the gamut, you know, and it's really wild. And he didn't call it enlightenment. He called it persistent non-symbolic experience, but that became too technical. So now he calls it fundamental well-being. And then he's like, well, we should figure out which techniques can most reliably transition somebody into a state of fundamental well-being the fastest. So they did these things called the Finder's Course experiments for 30 years. Wow. With thousands and thousands and thousands of people trying hundreds of techniques. And they've got it down to like 20 core techniques. And they learned some very interesting things. So number one, a technique might not be compatible for you that's super compatible for me, right? And a meditation technique that's compatible for you will transition you into fundamental well-being within 2 weeks. So you've got people who've been meditating for 40 years waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, oh, I know this is the day, and it doesn't happen because it's just not compatible with them, right? The other thing they learned is that if you're meditating for less than an hour, you're wasting your time, which is so annoying, right? Because who wants to do this for an hour, right? So, because something kicks in at the 40-minute mark, right? Which is when it starts, oh, you know, something's really happening. So after 30 years and thousands of people, they've now got this like 6-week program.
Wow.
And I did this program, and on day two, I did the meditation in the morning, It was super annoying. I could barely sit still for it. But I got through the hour. I went to a meeting in Hollywood with a screenwriter who was just like screaming at us. It was like super stressful. I get in my car to go to the next meeting and I'm just driving down Sunset Boulevard. And all of a sudden, again, this is day two of this program. All of a sudden, everything got really quiet. And kind of like felt like it kind of slowed down. And I was just overwhelmed with this sense of everything is perfect. Just this sense of like divine perfection. Right. And I'm like, what the fuck? And I pulled over in front of like Chick-fil-A and I'm just sitting there in my car, completely blissed out of my mind for like 3 hours. And I had to pull myself out of it because I had to go to work. Right. And so that program changed my life. And, you know, as a result of doing that, the way they describe fundamental well-being is the background noise of your life goes from being anxiety, like fundamental, not okayness, to fundamental okayness. So that's your baseline. So as someone who was diagnosed with an anxiety disorder and put on all kinds of medications forever, I never thought that I didn't know what it would even felt like to not have constant anxiety as the background noise of my life. So it's called the Finder's Course. I cannot recommend it enough. It's so amazing. And I totally recommend having Jeffrey on because he could talk about this way better than I can. But that's where like, anyone who's listening to this and is like, oh, maybe I should meditate. That's where you want to start, because you don't want to just, in my opinion, you don't want to just go learn TM and do it for 20 minutes twice a day. I mean, it works for some people. It works for a lot of people. But I'll tell you, it's not even in Jeffrey Martin's top 20 techniques.
I wouldn't have guessed it would be. Yeah. I learned from Dr. Joe Dispenza. I was one of his earlier students and, you know, and I was on the fast track because I was struggling a lot in my life with addiction and a lot of self-loathing and you know, as an actor, I was like completely emotionally fucking constipated. And my acting coach was like, dude, you got to find out why you built Fort Knox over your heart. And I was like, yeah, I fucking do. that's what kind of put me on this mission, which started with, you know, typical therapy. And then, you know, if you're on a mission to open your heart, you don't realize it. You know, I thought I was doing it to become a better actor. I wanted to be the next fucking Marlon Brando, but it's a noble mission. And inevitably it's a spiritual mission because, that's what I believe we're here for. And if you can learn to open your heart, you could start to learn to love yourself, you know, regardless of what you've done or what you are going to do. And that's kind of how I ended up finding Dr. Greer and his work. And it resonated so deeply with me, along my journey at the time. But it's amazing how you can go from, you know, a base level of quasi misery, depression, and anxiety to learning what works for you in order to just completely flatline those things. And then once in a while, things happen. Of course, you know, you're a human being living on earth at this time. Some things, you know, are going to get your heart rate up, you know, but coming back to it, always coming back to it is a practice. And you can quiet those voices. This is what people, I think, don't realize. You know, we have a lot of voices in our head and most of them aren't ours. You know, they're fucking old programming. They're adaptive programming from trauma and they're not doing us any good. So when you learn to quiet them, then you can start to rewrite your destiny, you know, as you move forward. That's what I did. And that's why I'm here talking to you. So but it's possible for everyone. And I'm going to definitely check out that. I had no idea that this study was done. This is amazing. I'm going to check it out. Talk about it.
Amen, brother. Yeah. And you try like 20 different techniques in 6 weeks, you know, and it's like every hour, every day. Cause it's like, hurry, we got to find the technique for you, you know? And, it's hard, you know? But once you find, and like 85% of people who do it will transition. Mm-hmm. And then for the other 15% who don't, they've got a follow-up 6-week course, and 100% of those people transition.
Wow.
So in the end, everybody gets to, you know, like,
you get a spiritual practice that fucking works for you.
Works in a few weeks, you know? And I have so many friends who are like, oh, that sounds nice, but, you know, an hour a day. It's like, yeah, an hour a day for like deep inner peace and walking to God and literally feeling like you have no problems. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, brother. So I wanted to ask you, man, what was the hardest thing to cut? I mean, I know as a director, there's always more than one, but the hardest thing you had to cut from both Unacknowledged and Close Encounters. Was there something that stands out for both of them? You were like, no, we have to leave that in. But then for whatever reason, you know.
Oh, man. Unacknowledged was, you know, that was like 7 years ago I was editing that. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah. What about The Lost Century?
Lost Century, we had a story about that was we always have to put these movies in front of our E&O attorneys, errors and omissions,
to make sure that we're not
going to get sued, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny because we say some crazy shit in these movies. So they're like, you know, for Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, they're like, well, what evidence do you have that the Prince of Liechtenstein wants to start a war with aliens? And we're like, oh, well, here's our documentation, you know? And they actually let us keep that one. Right. So I guess it was good enough. But for Lost Century, we had this whole sequence about this inventor who worked for General Motors, and he invented all kinds of patents for them. And then he invented, an engine that would just run forever, that didn't require fuel. Yeah. Or maybe it was a water engine, I don't remember. But basically it was like a ZPE. It was a zero point energy device, because even the engines that run on water, they're not really running on water. They're using water to tap into a zero point energy field.
The toroidal field. Yeah.
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 So, and he thought, oh boy, they're gonna love this. And, you know, according to the story, they pretended to love it, and then they killed it, you know. And then, you know, there were threats against him and his family, like mafia-like tactics, and we couldn't back it up, you know. We had X number of sources. We dug up, like, we even resorted to digging up old articles about like similar things that General Motors had done, you know, that was like in the LA Times, New York Times. Yeah. And the lawyers were like, we're not comfortable with this. So we're like, okay, fuck it. It's out. There's enough shit in here, you know?
Yeah.
So
there was enough shit in it, but
yeah.
Yeah.
And, with CE5, there was a fantastic sequence. We even created some great effects for it. And it was with my best friend Adam Curry, sort of riffing on the plant experiment. So for the people who don't know, Adam is a consciousness researcher. He worked in the Princeton Paralab, where they were studying consciousness and the effects of consciousness on physical systems. In other words, you know, telekinesis, you know, and telepathy. And they use these machines called random number generators, which, you know, you can think of it as like a coin flipper, except instead of heads or tails, it's ones or zeros. Right. And because it's truly random, over time you get 50% ones and 50% zeros. But if I say, Faust, use the power of your mind to make the machine produce more ones or more zeros, we find that this random process becomes ordered, right? Mm-hmm. And it'll spit, you know. So if I'm flipping, you know, a coin and it's heads or tails, and I say, okay, Faust, make me flip heads, and I flip 10 heads, it's a coincidence. But if I'm flipping millions of heads, at some mm-hmm. point we have to say, okay, some outside force is interfering with an right. otherwise random process. So that's what they found with these machines. So in the movie, Adam talks about an experiment he did where they put a plant in a room. It was divided into four quadrants, and they put it in one quadrant, and they had this sun lamp that was on a rotating arm, and it was controlled by one of these random number generators. And so it would just kind of randomly move throughout the room. And because it's truly random, it spends an equal amount of time in each quadrant, except the plant, the quadrant where the plant was in, attracted the light to it. Right. So it spent a statistically significant amount of time in that quadrant. So in this segment that was cut from the movie, he kind of extrapolates from that mm-hmm. and says, you know, we look at the universe and there are all the, like, you know, you could look at like the creationist versus evolution mm-hmm. arguments, and the creationists, you know, point out that there are all these physical constants, you know, these conditions in our universe that make it perfect for life, that statistically is so unlikely. It's like 10 to God knows how many powers.
It's fucking
right?
impossible. It's literally
impossible. Yeah. And so the evolutionists, they're counter to that is like, well, yeah, sure, but we live in a multiverse, and there's just an infinite number of universes, and we just happen to be in the one where all those conditions were right. Well, Adam suggests, well, you know, if you look at this plant experiment, it's like the consciousness of the plant is bending the probabilities of its yeah. environment, right? Mm-hmm. In favor of the development of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so if this is what consciousness does in the universe, right, it mm-hmm. bends the probabilities of its environment to promote the development and thriving of life, then that means that life has developed throughout the entire cosmos. It's not this rare thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. And so it was a really kind of like cool, long sequence, but it just got cut for time.
Yeah. Now I've seen Adam, and I'm always like, I got to get a hold of that man somehow, because I would love to talk to him on my show.
I'll hook you up.
Oh, awesome, bro. I appreciate that. He's so articulate. I'm always like, I want to know where he's, I see he's at a lab, you know, or at least that's the background, but he talks about his experiences, and I've heard him speak on more than one, you know, show and documentary. And I'm like, man, I got to talk to him, because the experiments he does talk about, you know, they sound right up my alley, you know, and there's been some remarkable experiments done. And of course the debunkers come out of the woodwork, your former self, you know, like there was a Rene Pioche did this incredible experiment with these ducks and he had a random movement generator. And what he did was he dressed it up like it was just a robot, but he made it look just enough like a duck, and he hatched these baby chicks, and he put the random number generator, divided into four quadrants, and he turned it on. And of course, you know, it moved at random, and basically covered all four quadrants about equally. Then he hatched the baby chicks and he let them imprint on this random movement robot. And then he put the baby chicks behind this screen, behind one of the quadrants. And so the baby chicks could see what they believed was their mother, but they could not go to it. They were fenced off. And then he turned the random movement generator in the robot on again. And the fucking machine stayed almost 75% closer to the ducks the whole time. And so people, you know, like the implication is that these baby chicks with their desire and love and this primal love they have for this machine that they've imprinted on it, they're affecting its movements, because here's the before, it's like everywhere, and here's the after, it's close to the chicks. And I'm like, if a baby chick can use its heart and mind in as primal and as simple as it is to affect a random movement machine, imagine what you can do as a human being. And people are like, well, that experiment's never been reproduced. I'm like, listen, it can be reproduced. Just do the rice experiment in your kitchen. You know,
that's right.
I mean, anyone can do the rice experiment. People are like, I don't believe in it. I'm like, why don't you fucking try it?
Yeah.
Before you believe in it.
Unbelievable. Exactly. It's like you fucking reproduce it. You got to have Adam on, and you got to ask him about the raccoon experiment. I won't spoil it.
Oh my God, I will.
But it is okay. It's so amazing. It's just as good as the duck thing you use, but it's different. It's very different.
Yeah.
But it's fucking mind blowing. It's about these raccoons that form a belief system and a ritual and are manifesting stuff. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Wow.
And it's a good time to have him on because he's about to publish an amazing paper about an update to the Turing test that he's calling T2 or Turing 2.
Oh, cool.
And he's suggesting this as a new standard, you know, for AI. It's crazy.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I'll hook you guys up.
Oh, awesome, man. That'd be so cool. I would love to talk to him. But, brother, this has been amazing. I just never thought that I would ever get a chance to speak to you, to speak to the director of my absolute
dude,
favorite.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's so cool, man. It's like a dream come true. It's I'm over the moon. I'm so much respect and love for you. You're extremely humble. You're doing amazing work, and I'm sure it's going to continue. Does the next doc have a name? Can we look forward to it? Would you like me? Is there somewhere people can find you if they want to keep up with what
I will come? I will come on here when we drop the trailer. It'll be in a few months. I want to have you to LA for the premiere. Oh, it's going to be fucking sick. It's the best thing I've ever done. I'm super stoked on it. It's a lot of fun. We got the new witnesses from DC, and we got some other stuff in there. Man. Some people who've never come forward. We've got insane phenomena images in here. We got Greer in here. It's going to be wild. I can't wait to hang out with you here.
Awesome, man.
Thank you for having me. This was a blast. It's so
thank
cool.
You
We're
for coming
fucking friends me. Now. So
absolutely, bro. Yeah. We're friends. I'm super excited. I'll reach out to you when this is going to premiere, and you know, we'll keep you posted on everything, but thank you so much for your time, brother. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Cheers.
We'll be in touch. Cheers, bro. Thanks so much.